I use the black image. But when I'm talking about the relationship of a mother and child, for instance, I'm not just addressing myself to a black mother and child. I'm addressing to all mother and children, you see? In other words, I'm placing the responsibility of the public to relate to a black image, but in terms of its universality, in terms of what it means to them.
This is Andromeda 21, a series of conversations, rap sessions, with speakers from the 1971 Afro-American Cultural Lecture Series held on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus. The purpose of these programs is to inform and inspire, to spread the realization that black is beautiful. The title of this program refers to the Ethiopian princess Andromeda, who, like us, was in chains, became free, and later took her place among the stars.
I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free.
My guest today is Mr. Charles White, perhaps the dean of black artists in the United States and abroad today. As I watched your exhibit yesterday, the first thing that came to my mind was this. You've given your lecture, you've given your speech already. And I wonder, what is the relevance of words for the artist who's already done his thing with painting? Do you have this problem, or do you think about it sometimes, Mr. White?
I used to think about the problem of trying to verbalize about the ideas that I can convey with a visual image. But I think it's necessary for the artist to be very articulate with words because it gives another dimension. The artist deals with visual images, but many times the visual images are abstractions of ideas. And to communicate and make more succinct his ideas, sometimes he has to use words.
I just felt it was unfair sometimes because you can have an exceptional artist who may be inarticulate.
I was practically nonverbal when I was when I was very, very young, particularly in, say, at high school age. I found it very difficult to talk to groups of people or even singularly to a person. I took a great deal of struggle to learn how to face people and to be able to handle words. I think the way I did it was that once I got over overcame the self-consciousness of the use of words, the self-consciousness of the way I structured my sentences, the self-consciousness of using the vernacular, it became no problem to talk to people. Because I did have a lot of things to say that words were the only tool that I could use. And I think it behooves every artist to overcome. If he has a problem, I think it better, because this is a verbal world, baby.
I'm convinced. Let me look over your career. I suppose if I'd want to make very elaborate comparisons, I could use that of the career of Beethoven, say, mm-hmm. standing between two worlds. Mm-hmm. In a way, it seems that you are at the tail end of the Harlem Renaissance and the beginnings of what Don Lee calls a new Renaissance, mm-hmm. the one apolitical, the new one political. Mm-hmm. How do you describe yourself in terms of these arbitrary chronological epochs here, the Harlem Renaissance, like you just got in on that, or was just about over when you started at the age of 19 with your award from the Institute, Art Institute in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So where do you put yourself now?
I like to identify myself with the new Renaissance. I like to think that I'm a part of this young revolutionary struggle. I inherited a great part of the old Renaissance, so to speak. Many of the important figures, literary as well as art figures of that period, eventually became part of my circle of friends.
And this was due partially to the early impetus you got. I believe at 19 you got the scholarship, is that right?
Yeah. And then I first met a very great, great scholar, one of our most important art scholars as well as literary scholars.
Dr. Alain Locke. He did an article about you, I believe.
Yeah, he included me in a book that he wrote called The Negro in Art. And this was really a first break in a terms of a national sense. And I eventually became a very close friend of Langston Hughes.
And you were still in your early 20s at this time, is that right?
Right. And, I guess because I identify so strongly with the new Renaissance is because I find that I have a very little rapport with my peers. And I find that I'm more stimulated and challenged, so to speak, by the youth of today than the people of my generation. There's a certain lethargy that has set in some of the older people. There's a certain lack of rapport or communication with youth. I've always been able to maintain the ability to communicate with you.
It's overwhelming. I notice a number of, say, Milton groups do sponsor you. Mm-hmm. You give shows for them, I believe.
Right.
And like you've maintained your vitality throughout this turbulent period.
Right. have seen, I guess I could see this, what we call a revolution. I could foresee it many years before it seemed to happen. I knew that the black man would have to reach a point where he would have to assert himself in a far more militant way than he had in the past.
It's like I guess some critics refer to you as a pioneer in blackness in that you saw the necessity for black dignity a long time before many people realized that the problem existed. Would you say that would be accurate, Mr. White?
I don't know, because my consciousness of blackness in terms of dealing with it as a basic content of my work was greatly influenced by Langston Hughes, who never lost that image in his work. He always dealt with it. The total output of his work was just that. I think Richard Wright, same thing. Now, you talk about, well, painters, the more visual arts. I think of an early playwright I used to know very, very well, a guy named Ted Ward, who wrote The Big White Fog, which was quite a landmark in theater. I think of Catherine Dunham, whose dance always dealt with the ethnic people's culture. I'm not the artist who looks necessarily to other painters for inspiration. So my source, my frame of reference was very often literature.
Yeah, I think many of us ordinary people didn't realize the need for black identity until the death of Malcolm X.
Well, interesting enough, there was another painter who, for many, many years, was a great, great interpreter of black life, and that was Hale Woodruff, who was for many years chairman of the art department at Atlanta University, which was a real important seat of learning the craft, as well as being encouraged by this man to go out, for the students to go out and deal with black life. Now, Haywood later abandoned that kind of content and message in his work for a more avant-garde, say, imagery. But he was a great, he's an older person than I, and was a part of the black Renaissance. Or I could think of Richmond Barthé, a sculptor, who was a part of that Renaissance, who always, again, dealt with this back. These are the cats who you know, who I related to very strongly. And then being brought up in Chicago, where the you dealt with your environment. That was a characteristic of all the Chicago artists of my time. We just went out in the streets and painted, yeah. You see. So it was a very natural kind of thing to relate to. And so the evolution is to move into other eras where this was being so-called, lack of emphasis, say, shall we say, was being placed on this. I had already been formed.
I see. Way ahead of
yeah.
us.
So, yeah, man, it was just, you know, it wasn't, I just was, never occurred to me to entertain another kind of material mm-hmm. to deal with.
So you do ally yourself to the new Renaissance. We'll say, how do you reconcile this with the problem of realism in art? It seems that a great deal of your works are very, very much realistic. How do you handle that, or is that a problem? I noticed what I could see is some sort of evolution in your works, like the ones of the 70s mm-hmm. seem more symbolic than some of the others. How would you discuss this problem with me of the evolution of realism or non-representational art in your work?
Well, the artist always has two major problems to deal with, and that's form and content. Some artists choose to place the emphasis on form, which inevitably leads to a very abstract, non-objective kind of approach to the material. If the form dominates, then it dominates the content, so to speak, then inevitably this abstract quality begins to emerge, and one sees that first, it relates to that first. I have always, in this battle of form versus content, I have always chose to make the content more dominant. And yet, at the same time, one cannot negate the whole question or the whole challenge of form. I relate very strongly to some of the most avant-garde of art. I relate very strongly to Picasso, so to speak, who is not really way out at this point, but at one point was. I relate to Willem de Kooning, who is a very abstract expressionist. I relate to some hard-edged things. We'll say Mondrian, mm-hmm. for instance. I can see, because the artist has to learn from his fellow artists, and he has to deal with this on a two-dimensional surface, form and content. He can sometimes best learn the challenge of dealing with this formidable problem of form by looking to the most abstract rather than the realist. The realist, you get some idea of the content and meaning of the thing. You see, you learn from that aspect.
I think I can understand another aspect of your art, too. On the one hand, while content seems to be the more important thing yeah. you've related to, and that's blackness, I believe.
Right.
Still, your art has universal traits.
I'm glad you see it that way, because so many people don't, particularly white people, because I use the black image. But when I'm talking about the relationship of a mother and child, for instance, I'm not just addressing myself to a black mother and child. I'm addressing to all mother and children, you see? In other words, I'm placing the responsibility of the public to relate to a black image, but in terms of its universality, in terms of what it means to them.
Yes.
You understand? That it can't... I want all people to look upon this image and get something out of it that's meaningful to them.
I think this comes yeah. off as the first time one sees one of your mm-hmm. drawings, mm-hmm. and I was overwhelmed by the Jacques number 6, mm-hmm. a painting which I call the Black Prometheus with mm-hmm. my classical background. Seems as if the figure, the colossal figure, was touching the sky mm-hmm. and was as big as the earth. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly universal, even though it's a black
yeah.
face.
Mm-hmm.
And so this brings up another interesting point. Let me ask you, let me quote something from James Porter about you and see what you can do with it. He says, and I quote, "Charles White is one of the great voices among black Americans who during the past 30 years have been the real interpreters of the American Negro." So you get a problem of universality, of identity
right.
in that quote.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there was a time when you could be offended by the word black in there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And today it's like a badge of honor.
Right.
So tell me, how do you handle a passage like that? We've almost given it away.
Well, I've made the change, so to speak, and some of my peers haven't. Prefer to be colored, be called Negro. I prefer to be called black. It makes more sense, really. And I don't object to it. I don't object to black shows, for instance. Some of my artist friends object to all black shows.
But there was a time in the 40s when that was taboo. I mean, like a stigma, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was though you're being segregated in a sense. But I think there's a question of black pride, a question of a sense and awareness of your own background and a feeling of really feeling you're beautiful, baby. And you want everybody to know it. And so sometimes the only way you can let them know it is by getting together and making it such a formidable presentation, you know, that they can't ignore it. You know, the whole question of hair or something, you know, the growing of naturals. You know, there's one time when the Cab Calloway was the idol of all black cats, you know, because, man, he could throw that hair around and he just hung all in his eyes when he was animated.
Sure.
And now, you know, and we used to want to do that. You know, I want to process my hair.
Right. Well, Sugar Ray.
Yeah. See, but now, man, the brother lets it go. So beautiful, natural, and man, that's a sense of beauty. That even as an artist, the imagery is so much it's so much more beautiful than trying to paint a cat with slick hair.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I'm still overwhelmed by your career because we mentioned the scholarship you got at the Art Institute in Chicago at the age of 19. You were teaching. I believe you were just 21. Were you 21 or 22 when you started teaching at the Southside Art Center in Chicago?
I was about 20. About
20 years old.
About 20 years old. And
what do you attribute to your early recognition, Mr. White?
I wish I knew. I really don't know. I think sometimes it's just pure luck in that people sort of helped me considerably. I guess maybe my commitment was so obvious. It was a total commitment. There was never any question that I was totally dedicated to being an artist. I had been totally committed since I was 7.
Wow.
I never wanted to work for the post office or work on the railroad. Very noble ambitions at one point in our culture. But I had just assumed that I would never be a professional artist, but I knew I would be an artist.
I mean, was there any one person in particular who, say, discovered you at that early age and helped you to get going?
There were two people, and Dr. Locke, who I've mentioned already, and a young painter who unfortunately died very, very young, but who was instrumental in helping a number of the black artists of that period. And that was a guy by the name of George Neal, a very talented man, but one of the few who had the opportunity when I was very young, who was studying at the Art Institute, and he used to have little classes at settlement houses on the south side of Chicago. And many of the young artists, black artists, had the privilege of studying under George. And George was a very sensitive man who encouraged us, and he was able, had that perceptiveness, to be able to pick out special talents. And I think nobody has never heard of him at this point, but he was an important figure, which we all recognize.
It's an amazing bit of luck. I remember the first time I talked to Mark Tobey, he said, he was 60, he was in New York, 10 years before anybody would look at him. And before he got his thing going through an article in Time, he was 60 years old.
Well, you know, William de Kooning was practically a middle-aged man before he was recognized. Jackson Pollock was in his late 30s before he was really fully recognized. This is true, a classic example. But many young artists today get recognized in their 19, 23. Unfortunately, they stand out to some of my students who feel that if they haven't made it at 23, they've finished, you know?
No, it's very, very unfortunate they have that, but I know that, as Toby mentioned, a great deal of bitterness can set in when you don't make it and you're 35, 40, 50. Mention very talented people who are in despair.
Depends on your makeup. I've been fighting for a long time, and I kind of it's like a bullfighter in a way. You live on a precipice, and at certain points that precipice becomes so fascinating, you don't feel comfortable unless you are living on a precipice.
Mm-hmm.
And you court disaster. You see, like a bullfighter. And it's fascinating activity. You know, I that's the only way I can explain it. You have to be, fascinated by it.
Well, it's almost like the grind in television of staying alive. I noticed you win an award at least every 2 years, mm-hmm. and sometimes mm-hmm. almost every year you win an award of some kind.
I'm very fortunate in that I have a very good income from the sale of my works. And I have a very satisfying job teaching at a college in Los Angeles.
Is that Otis?
Otis Art Institute, which is basically a graduate school. Coupled with all these things of two beautiful kids, a beautiful old lady, all in all, I've reached a point where life is very pleasant. And I wake up each morning looking forward to the day. The unique thing, I think, about all of this is that I enjoy what I do. There's so many people who have to work and don't enjoy what they do. It's imagine spending a whole lifetime working and not being able to look forward to the day, each day.
That's the ordinary American.
Yeah, but man, that's why art is so great, you see? You can feel that way.
On the other hand, this is the question that fascinates me about artists of all types. It seems that while you're the exception, I'd have to say, the norm for at least the artists I know is kind of an agonizing spiritual existence. And out of this agony, often great work of art is created. Now, you don't seem to fit that type at all, but do you see any truth to the kind of thing I'm saying?
That imagery is exists in real life. Some of it is a stereotype image, been created by fiction,
mm-hmm.
and compounded with a visual thing like a movie.
Uh-huh.
You see, so that you constantly get the image of a Van Gogh and his neuroses and his agonizing experience. I think most of the painters I've known get a great joy out of their existence, no matter whether it's poor, struggle, whether they seem to be unrecognized. Artists have a capacity for living. They have a capacity for enjoyment. They live very rigorously. They're outgoing. They're not very repressed in expressing their feelings. In, whether it be love, enjoyment, or what, you see? It's something about the nature of the activity itself, a freedom, if you please.
Yeah, it's an enviable existence.
Yeah, you know, independence and a defiance, huh?
Right.
A defiance of the mores of a society, you know? We don't fit the concept what a man should be, a woman should be, huh? You don't go to from 9 to 5 at a job, so therefore you look on with suspect. So you create our little world, your own little world. Society has rejected the artist since the end of the Renaissance.
Yeah. I suppose it's like a high priest of art.
Right.
Well, the 60s brought on a, say, new kind of catalyst to the black movement.
Mm-hmm.
And is there any way in which this new impetus for blackness affected your work?
Yeah, in a sense, it gave me a beautiful assurance that the pendulum was swinging my way. That was a point in my life when, as it's been said, that I stood out for virtue of being the only one doing the black image, so to speak. I used to sort of attempt to do sort of genre scenes, scenes of people working in the fields and try to do it in a new way, that a different way than it had been done before. And instead of showing the tired, downtrodden worker out in the field, I tried to show that the man took pride in his work, even in spite of all his problems. I tried to show, in spite of a mother existing in the slums with a kid, that she hadn't been defeated by the pathos of the situation or the crucialness of the situation. As the new wave of militancy, the new attitudes began to develop, I began to deal more symbolically with the struggle and trying to make my symbols relate to the currency of the times. I looked to the acts, the activists, shall we say, the activists and the acts that they perform, say like a Martin Luther King and the marches and the bus strikes and so forth. I looked to find looked into those movements to find the spirit of movement. What was that mysterious thing that moved these people to face such tremendous odds and do it in such a dignified, militant way?
It seems like that you hit the one word, yeah. I guess, which most characterizes your art, which mm-hmm. is dignity, which you were able to convey. Mm-hmm. And whether this is verbal mm-hmm. or not, I don't know whether you can mm-hmm. convey this verbally, can you?
It's very difficult to try to do it, unless you got the thing right there. I can
right. I wish
talk
I could
about, yeah.
show the pictures yeah. on radio, but I know after having seen some of your works exactly what you mean. It's an amazing transition, if I can even call it transition, because, as you know, one of the most difficult tasks today for a black person mm-hmm. even is to keep up with the times. Mm-hmm. They change every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And you seem to have done that admirably. What kind of, you're on our college campus, now what kind of message, and I suppose the young black students will be looking for a message from you, what do you have to tell black college students in the 70s?
I don't presume to really tell them anything. I consider myself so much more of a student of the black, young black person, rather than a teacher of the black person. I will share my experiences with him, and hopefully there's something there that he can learn by. But I'm so avidly and trying to submerge myself into the young black movement to learn myself. I have so much room to grow. There's so much I have to learn. There's so much I have to work. You have to work a little harder the older you get in the learning process. True that I've been formed to the extent where there won't necessarily be tremendous radical changes, but I hope my youthfulness will be retained in the same way that Dr. Du Bois, who at 90 years old was still in the process of learning.
As I look at you now and talk to you and see your works, I continue to be overwhelmed at the, let's say, perpetual youth that you exhibit in your person and in your art. And it's been a great honor for me to talk to you today, Mr. Charles White, perhaps the dean, may I even say, of all black artists in the United States and the world.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish.
This has been Andromeda 21, another in the series of conversations with speakers from the 1971 Afro-American Culture Lecture Series held on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus. Your host for this series is Hank Parker, instructor in the Department of Classics at the University of Illinois.
All the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man.
Andromeda 21 was produced and directed by Louise Geislers for WILL, the radio service of the University of Illinois in Urbana.